John Pilcher is a world-renowned journalist, author and documentary filmmaker who since 1958 has represented the highest standards of eyewitness reporting. As the playwright Harold Pinter put it, John Pilcher unearths with steely attention the facts, the filthy truth, and tells it like it is. An impassioned critic of Western intervention across the world, he's been a foreign correspondent and a frontline war reporter beginning with the Vietnam War in 1967. His work, according to Noam Chomsky, has been a beacon of light in often dark times. The realities he's brought to light have been a revelation over and over again, and his courage and insight a constant inspiration. And now, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to introduce our keynote speaker, John Pilcher.
Thank you, Sally, and thank you to Westminster University and my media colleagues here for inviting me to speak today. I suppose my remarks are addressed primarily at students, but also at those who teach them. Investigative journalism. My first assignment as an investigative journalist was around the time of my 18th birthday. I was working the graveyard shift on the Sydney Sun, and my job was to investigate potential crime stories and listen in to the local police radio. On my second night, I fell asleep. The next morning, I found myself in front of the news editor, whose name was Big Lou Del Puget, and he wore blue suede shoes, as news editors all did today. You know what you've missed. You know what we've missed because of you, he shouted at me. He produced a copy of our rival, whose front page headline said, Police Probe Models Fatal Fling. That's what we missed because of you, shouted Big Lou, whereupon I passed out at his feet. When I came to, I could hear a voice saying, Hey Lou, maybe he's got a weak heart or something. Maybe you killed him. So I moved to another paper, another assignment. I was sent to investigate why a mysterious swarm of bees had nested on a car park in the middle of a shopping centre. The police had summoned the bee man, who was at work in his anti-sting shroud when I arrived. Guided by terror, I forged through the crowd and said to the bee man, Excuse me. Whereupon I was stung between the eyes, and I passed out. The next day, all the newspapers, including my own, published a picture of the only victim of the mystery bee, sitting in the gutter with his head in his hands, me. I mention these early reminiscences as a reminder of the often farcical nature of this odd occupation called journalism. And above all, of the humanity that is the essence of journalism. Perhaps falling on my face in those early days helped me to understand that a journalist should always see the world from the ground up, never from the top down. In this way, I believe, you have a good chance of being independent. This can be troublesome, because those in the so-called mainstream are expected to work from the top down. In other words, we journalists are conditioned, even groomed, to observe the rest of humanity through a telescope provided by those in authority, and I speak broadly about authority, by our employers, by our education, by our internalizing so many of the rules of how we are meant to perceive the world. In this way, we become the agents of power, not of people. Understanding the subtleties of that conditioning and understanding the great privilege we journalists exercise is vital, I think, if we are to claim that precious commodity, independence. For you can't be a so-called investigative journalist unless you are truly independent. And your skepticism is reserved to those in power who never believe anything until it's officially denied, is my all-time favorite quotation from great muckraker Claude Cove. The term investigative journalism didn't exist when I started as a journalist. I suppose we're all meant to investigate. Rather than narrow this contribution today to the triumphs and trials of the Woodwards and Bernsteins, as well put by Sally, I'd like to challenge the whole idea of serious journalism as it's practiced in the mainstream and how it's taught, generally speaking, in universities and colleges. A few questions first. Why are some young journalists who begin what we call idealistic, then persuaded they must adopt a ready-made cynicism about their readers, viewers, and listeners if they are to be ordained as journalists? Why is the most virulent censorship in mainstream journalism, censorship by omission, rarely spoken about? Why are young journalists not alerted to this and to forms of media propaganda such as war by journalism and democracy by journalism? Why are some media courses merely factories for jobs that serve these propaganda works? And why aren't young journalists, right at the beginning of their careers, alerted to the political dimension that dominates so much media, disguised as best practice or set up in terms of nostrums like objectivity and so on, in the BBC? And when any of these proper questions are raised, why are experienced journalists and broadcasters too often defensive, even resentful, as if theirs is a kind of closed masonry? And that applies, principally, in my experience, to famous journalists. The other day, President Bush's former spokesman, Scott McClellan, blew the final whistle on the lies of the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq. What he said, we knew, of course. And what he said was not nearly as important as the way he described journalists. He used the term compliant enablers. In effect, what he said was that without this small army of compliant enablers, the lies he told on behalf of Bush would not have led to the invasion of Iraq. In other words, the compliant enablers had given us war by journalism. And in a country where the press is nominally freer than anywhere on earth, this was a sensational revelation from deep inside the American establishment. Yet what was striking about the media coverage of McClellan's confession was the abuse heaped on him and the suppression of his description of the role of journalists in the great lie machine. In most of the British press, the words complicit enablers simply didn't appear. Why not? Well, it would have to be explained, wouldn't it? Better to call in glib commentators like Christopher Hitchens to sneer the whistleblower rather than tell the public the truth about how so much of the mainstream media actually works. What McClellan was saying was that had professional journalists done their job, had they not amplified and echoed his lies, but challenged them, investigated them, perhaps up to 1 million people might be alive today. In Britain, things are not the same, but always. Read Nick Davies' chapter on The Observer in Flat Earth News, and you'll quickly understand the meaning of complicit enablers. The fake investigations connecting Saddam Hussein with Al-Qaeda, the collaboration of Blair and Campbell are shocking, though not surprising. Neither is it surprising that this, the most revealing chapter in Davies' book, has been brushed over by reviewers with no mention of the suppression of Edgar Yarmouth's pre-invasion scoop, though it was all based on lies. Of course, this suppression, the censorship by omission, none of it is new. go back to the slaughter of the First World War, and there's Prime Minister Lloyd George confiding in C.P. Scott, editor of the Manchester Guardian, I quote, "If people really knew the truth, the war would be stopped tomorrow, but of course they don't know, and they can't." Unquote. According to the historian Arthur Ponsonby, there was no more discreditable period in the history of journalism than the 4 years of the war. I would dispute that. Nothing is more important than a nation going to war, and nothing is more important than one government invading another country. And that's why I concentrate here on the reporting of war. The Nuremberg Tribunal calls an invasion like that of Iraq the paramount war crime, from which come all other war crimes. And that criminal sense of what we have done is rarely described as such in the mainstream. For every British war and invasion in the modern era, I've seen journalists enrolled as cheerleaders, as complicit enablers, while claiming objectivity, impartiality, balance. Now, I'm not suggesting, I hasten to say, any kind of conspiracy here, which in any case is quite unnecessary. We journalists and broadcasters are no different from other elite members in internalizing the priorities and fashions of established power. Like all those with important establishment responsibilities, we're expected to set aside serious doubts. If skepticism is encouraged, it's directed not at the system, but at the competence of its managers, its politicians, its functionaries, or at popular attitudes as we perceive it. From the Murdoch press to the BBC, the undeclared rules of the media club vary, but not by much. Invisible boundaries allow false premises to become received wisdom and official perceptions to be channeled and amplified and called news. Again, the question begs, why is so little of this explained in media courses? Why are student journalists not given a sense of their own vulnerability to state propaganda and told how they might protect themselves, given a kind of survival kit? For example, how many media courses teach that behind a one-way moral and legal decree provided by the media in a free society, the unthinkable can be validated and normalized, such that the physical and social destruction of an entire society that is a Nuremberg crime? Put aside for a moment the 2003 invasion and consider the 500,000 children who, according to UNICEF, died as a result of an Anglo-American-led embargo in the 1990s. "We think the price is worth it," said Madeleine Albright on CBS. The reporter who asked that question has since been sworn to say nothing, and the clip is never available. How many investigative journalists have bothered to examine the United Nations records where the evidence of this denial and carnage can be found? How many have bothered to investigate the ironically named no-fly zone established by Clinton and Blair over Iraq and which produced the longest Allied aerial bombardment in history, more often than not against civilian targets? And how many have revealed the extent of the recent aerial onslaught on Shiites in Sabra City, the very people we are meant to be liberating, and the Hiroshima-like effects of toxic munitions such as depleted uranium, and the dying of children in Iraqi hospitals for want of a syringe and rubber gloves? The exceptions to this question are honourable indeed. Among them, Patrick Curtin of The Independent, Nir Rosen, Dar Jamal, but the last two you'll read only on the internet. There are others, of course. When the BBC's director of television, Helen Bird, is asked, "How is it that reporters can stand in front of the camera and say with a straight face that the reason for the invasion was a desire on the part of Bush and Blair to bring democracy to Iraq. She replies, and I quote, "It is simply a fact that Bush has tried to export democracy," unquote. And her evidence for this fact are statements by Bush and Blair, but this appeals their attention. In a recent study of media responses in the Soviet Union to questions about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the replies were almost identical to Helen Burden's. The official truth is the only truth. The difference is, this is the free society. Through our one-way moral mirror, the fate of whole societies is so often reported according to their usefulness to us. Us being the term frequently used for Western power. With good terrorists in Kosovo and bad terrorists in Serbia. Good Arabs in Saudi and bad Arabs in Syria. Good Kurds in Iraq and bad Kurds in Turkey. Worthy victims in Israel, unworthy victims in Gaza, and so on. With honourable exceptions, and I repeat, honourable exceptions, this is the way the world is so often presented, day after day, night after night. The illusions that come with this conformity have a history. In the 19th century, newspapers in the English-speaking world were wild cards, often edited by fiercely independent types who regarded unaccountable power as their natural enemy. They were truly investigative journalists. Let me describe one of them. His name was Edward Smith Hall. In 1826, in the colony of New South Wales, which was then effectively a military dictatorship, Hall launched his weekly 8-page, 8-penny newspaper, The Sydney Monitor. On the front page, in large type, was a definition of a journalist as, and I quote, "He is an inveterate," geez, weren't applicable then, "he is an inveterate opposer rather than a staunch parasite of the government." I like that. Paul exposed corruption and malfeasance, and he demanded democracy on behalf of his readers. He refused to befriend any journalists. The idea of the lobby would have appalled him. He was often in jail pending trial for criminal defamation, the favourite device then for suppressing unpalatable truths. I would say he was the very best kind of investigative journalist, and the public supported his principled audacity, so much so that perhaps more than anyone, this one journalist planted the seeds of three basic liberties in his country: freedom of the press, representative government, and trial by jury. Another kind of journalism arrived with the advent of advertising early in the last century. As the new corporations in the United States began taking over the press, something called professional journalism was invented. And the Edward Smith Halls were made pretty well extinct. All they were shunted into the margins as not really one of us. To attract big advertisers, the new corporate press had to appear respectable, pillars of the establishment, objective, impartial, balanced. The first schools of journalism were set up with pretensions that matched their corporate backing. A mythology of liberal neutrality was spun around the so-called professional journalist. What the public didn't know was that in order to be professional, journalists were trained to ensure that news and opinion had to be, in effect, validated and dominated by official sources, and that hasn't changed. Should you doubt that, in the United States and here, a simple test is to check the sources of the main political stories, domestic and foreign, and you'll find that most of them are dominated by government and other established interests, invested interests, often spun by the newly powerful PR industry. That's the essence of professional journalism. Now, I'm not suggesting that independent journalism was or is excluded, but it's more likely to be an honourable exception. In 1983, the principal global media was owned by about 50 corporations, most of them American, In 2002, this had fallen to just 9 corporations. Rupert Murdoch has predicted that there will be just 3 global media giants, and his company will be one of them. All these companies, as the famous anchorman Dan Rather of CBS has since made clear, supported governments and their bloody adventures directly and indirectly. A vivid example is the way the other colonial adventure in Afghanistan is reported. This bloody disaster is now reported almost exclusively through the British Army. There's no human enemy, no national resistance to the foreigners and their puppet regime, only something called the Taliban. The Taliban are bad. Squaddies are good. That's the story. A squaddie now files directly to the Guardian. That's how the Duke of Wellington got a good press for Waterloo, he reported himself. In Afghanistan, the fact that thousands of ordinary people have been killed by us is mentioned only when the atrocity can't be ignored or NATO can't cover it up. It never happened. Wrote Harold Pinter. Nothing ever happened. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter, it was of no interest. So what can be done? Well, I believe a fifth estate is possible. A kind of public movement that monitors, deconstructs, and counters what is now rightly called the corporate media. In every university, in every media college, in every newsroom, teachers of journalism, journalists themselves, need to ask themselves about the part they now play in the bloodshed in the name of bogus objectivity. The very notion of a journalist needs to be changed to someone charged with retrieving vital information from the oblivion to which it's so often consigned. Such a movement within the media could herald a sort of perestroika of a kind that we've never known. This is all possible. Silences can be broken. They have to be broken. In Britain, as we're now aware, a surveillance and war-making state constantly demands more information from us, that knows almost everything about us, that can read our emails, our bank statements, even our DNA, has to be called to account. 40 million CCTV cameras can't be wrong, as one policeman quipped recently. But we need to make haste. Liberal democracy, I believe, is moving towards a form of corporate dictatorship, although we may notice, may not notice. This is quite an historic shift, and the media must not be allowed to be its facade. If those of us who are meant to keep the record straight don't do that, who will? That great whistleblower, Tom Paine, warned that if the majority of the people were denied truth and the ideas of truth, it was time to storm what he called the Bastille of Words. Well, I think that time is now. Thank you.
Although we don't seem to have questions scheduled, it seems rather fitting not to potentially allow John Trust to go away without answering a few. Is there anybody inviting to make a chance to ask a question? Please.
I'm a school social worker, and I've come here because I want to learn about you as journalists, what you do. And I agree totally with what John Trust just said. And
I did actually come thinking, this is going to be all about Iraq and Iran, not about the UK, and I'm very pleased to hear your last comments, because I really think it's time that we got together as journalists and social workers to do something about this, because there is so much damage being done to so many people in our country.
Any more? Any questions?
I worked for quite a meeting last night, the first time I was astonished that the programme was possible to make, a programme which
talked about mutiny going on in an army and officers being shot in the back. Do you think that kind of program would be possible today? And do you think those kind of circumstances are still applying today in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq?
I mean, very quiet mutiny, someone made for World in Action in 1970 after the mutiny within the American army in Vietnam. No, the answer to your question. Where's World in Action? Where's anything like World in Action? You know, I started working, I've worked through pretty well every ITV company and watched them all disappear from beneath me. The company that made that is still around, Granada, but in very different form, very commercial. There was a sense of journalism, of the kind of touch of the Edward Smith Halls in World in Action at the time. Yes, I think that in other strands it's possible to put it out. There isn't, I mean, in those days there was quite a direct attempt at censorship. I had to run absolutely every word through what was then the IBA. And they ran pencils through the script, cut stuff out, the sort of thing you wouldn't think you could possibly accept. I argued never in life with my producers. Even that film had to be argued for weeks before it was allowed to go out in a truncated form. That isn't so now. But there just isn't the space. Then there was the space. The space is now evaporated. And that's a much more effective form of censorship in my view. So there isn't perhaps the opportunity for perhaps a young version of me then to go into television in that way. There are other ways, of course, and I don't want to throw cold water on that at all, but it's easier to survive if you can look back on too many years like.
You said that you thought media and journalism teachers were not teaching student journalists the right kind of thing. I think you suggested that there was more of the right kind of thing to talk about. My impression is that it's not the teachers of journalism and media that's to blame. It's the people who don't are not very interested. Do other colleagues agree that in fact very few students are really interested in the kind of journalism that John Phillips has been talking about?
But it's like blaming the readers.
Yeah.
Well, everyone's watching. Sorry. You know, that's the easiest thing to do. I've been to so many universities and been cosseted with teachers, lecturers, they have a problem with them all, they're on the net all the time, what they're doing, you know. And it's always them. That's not the impression I get. I've talked to many students, informally and formally, and the impression I get that not all was never all, but a significant minority of them are interested in going another way.
I'm a manager of the Waterhouse. I'm the Rider City University, where we've just launched an MA in investigative journalism. And John's right, there are a significant minority. But the applicants we had this year and last year are passionate and idealistic. Plus, we've also had, we have a specialist in investigative journalism, our third year undergraduates do investigative journalism. There is a serious desire among a very significant minority of students, and they will make a difference, but it'll take a few years for them to come through. And I just hope that there are media outlets that will let them do that.
I'm joking, minority. I'm joking, right.
It's Gavin McTaggart from the Centre for Investigative Journalism. And one of the problems that you mentioned struck a chord with me, because in most universities in Britain, you find next to the journalism department a very large and effective and well-funded department of PR. And so the spin people and the entire apparatus that journalists in their working life have to oppose if they have any principle at all is being taught just down the corridor. All the methods of spin and deception that we have to confront in a normal way. This isn't considered in most universities to be in any way outrageous. I was wondering, John, what your thought about that?
You had a conflict speaking. I think we know about PR, and we know about its influence. I remember reading PR Week some time ago, this is quite a few years ago, their own study, how they saw the influence of PRs in the daily papers. I mean, they used, and I think I'm almost right, something like a majority of the city papers were directly influenced by PR. The sport pages were influenced by PR, and the whole PR throughout. And I think it's where Nick Davis has made good points in his book about the line being blurred now between journalists and PR. So that's almost prevented journalists from thinking about perhaps some of the ideas that I've raised today, that they're forever trying to get on with their job. The journalist, Nick called it. But that's not the only problem. It is about understanding about structure. It's like those who are falling over backwards and suggest that Obama and Barack could get all that different in the United States. Yes, very different from Bush. And that's a very good thing. But no, because there's no evidence to suggest he will be different. And it's about structure. And I think the structure of journalism is something that ought to be debated.
Let's take one more, few more questions before we get on with the next session. Thank you, bye.
Hi, I'm Sophie.
Well, I haven't met you, but it looks like you've got the mic. You've got the power.
It's all right. Yes, thank you for a wonderful speech. I'm Viviana from the Norwegian Foundation of Investigative Journalism. We're also arranging a wonderful conference in September, I should mention that. But I really like your perception or your point about bogus objectivity. We have this wonderful investigative journalist in Norway. He's made several films. He's also working with Tom Heinemann in Denmark. But he doesn't call himself a journalist anymore. He calls himself an activist. And listening to you, I'm thinking, okay, where do you draw the line between journalism and activism? And this paired with the concept of bogus objectivity, I'd really like to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I don't know where you draw the line, and you have to ask. I edited an anthology of investigative journalism a couple of years ago, and all those famous names from Martin Gellhorn to Edward R. Murrow, Seymour Hersh, and Jessica Bedford, and many others. And I think that undoubtedly they would all want something there to be a consequence of their journalism. There's no question about that. But the problem with the word activist is that it's loaded. So I wouldn't want to even begin to draw the line. It's a loaded word.
But I think it's absolutely right that journalists think of the consequence of their work. The idea that they can simply walk away from something that they've revealed, or that they're part of, or imagine themselves as some kind of, the moment they walk into a great institution like the BBC, they rise to an Obama of purity, where there's a kind of fulcrum on which they sit on. And, you listen to someone like Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, was the only journalist in the United States who got what Scott McClellan was talking about, got it right. And he said recently about objectivity, that's fine, but I'm more interested in the facts. And that there is the idea that there might be two sides sitting in the studio is all very well, and he wasn't denying the validity of that. But the facts overrode it. And I suppose somebody like he could be called an activist, because undoubtedly he influenced a great number of people in the United States to understand what was happening over Iraq. It's a good subject, and it touches on what I've been talking about today. And I'm very, very much welcome discussion on that and hearing from others where they think it begins and ends. But at the same time, never forgetting that the most potent activism comes from those who deny they are.
Are you going to stay from the discussion?
I'm going to stay for the panel through here today.
You've given us a lot to think about, a lot to feel guilty about. Thank you very much.